Hey, it's me. And yes, it's been a while. But the good news is, we're back. Well, almost. We've got a fresh batch of stories lined up for release in February 2026. But I wanted to get this episode to your ears as early in the new year as possible. My executive producer and I are also very excited to let you know that your favorite podcast, this one, made it onto the Tink Media Audio Delicacies list for 2025. Something Shifted joined Heavyweight, The Girlfriends, and a slew of other incredibly creative shows, and honestly, we're still reveling in the joy. But in preparation for season four of Something Shifted, we wanted to offer you a sweet treat to savor as the holidays come to an end. Perhaps you, like Rue, are plotting your resolutions for a brand new year. Or maybe like me, you're still selecting your word for 2026. And with all the uncertainty and the potential that a new year brings, what is the case for optimism? Okay, let's backpedal a bit. You see, our New Year's resolution for 2025 was a joy jar. A humble, empty coffee jar, of which we have many. Maybe we need to drink less coffee in 2026. Nonetheless, a joy jar because we're not so good at sticking to resolutions in the Lewitz household. And because we struggle to remember what we had for dinner the previous night, the only goal for 2025 was to plant little flags for ourselves. You know, to hold on to some good stuff, which we may have forgotten by the time the Christmas lights go up at the end of the year. And like most resolutions, the first couple of months were the easiest. The joy jar lived in the kitchen, in the middle of our house. And on weekends, we would jot down happy things from the week on small pieces of brightly colored paper and fold them up and leave them in the jar. Even though the joy jar got dusty at times, I mean, we even misplaced it for a short while, it became a fixture in our minds. Throughout the year, we often said, "Ooh, we should put that in the joy jar." And in 2025, it was like it became easier to spot the countless things that were going right, or well, or happily. And some of them were big, like finally replacing the rickety garage door after 11 years. And some of them were small, like a really good cup of coffee. It's the coffee thing again. But the more we looked for it, the more joy we had. And in many ways, our lives were still the same. You know, I'm still an entrepreneur hustling to build a business, and Rue was still burnt out from a career in academia. Zoe is still having seizures, and her special needs did not go away. The economy was probably worse off. Wars raged on, and Trump, well, let's just not go there. But somehow 2025... it still felt like a good year. And we were starting to feel a little optimistic.
So optimism actually didn't start out as a psychological trait.
This is Shumit. We met because my friends at Jonathan Ball Publishers sent me a copy of his book, The Bright Side. And it was the subtitle, Why Optimists Have the Power to Change the World, that really piqued my interest.
I think I'm not really a triumph kind of guy in the sense that I tend to want something or want to achieve something. Then I kind of work my way towards it without necessarily having it kind of front and center. And then I kind of get on with the next thing.
He says that like becoming the editor-in-chief of New Scientist magazine isn't a big deal. Newsflash, it is.
Beginning of that story is actually starts a long time before I got the job. It starts when I was about 7 or 8, and I used to go up with my dad every now and again to his offices in London during the holidays. You could do that sort of thing then. And I found piles of this magazine, New Scientist, lying around in his office. He worked in chemistry. And I thought, hey, this is cool because I like science and I liked writing. So I asked him, I said, well, how this magazine gets made? Who makes it? And he said, the editor would look after that. So I thought, all right, that's the job for me. But then over time, I kind of held on to this somewhere in the back of my mind as being this is where I want to get to. When I was studying, I had to choose between science and writing. So I chose science for various reasons. Graduated from physics, decided I really wanted to go back to writing. I wanted to be a journalist. And the only kind of job I could really get in journalism as a physicist was covering finance. But, you know, I thought, I'm going to try my hand. So I wrote to the person who was at that point the editor of New Scientist, actually the features editor, and said, can I have a job? I like science. I like writing. And he wrote back and said, get some experience, basically. Prove you can do something. So I did the finance journalism for a long time, for 10 years or so. And then eventually, and I had a succession of life changes. And I thought, you know, it's about time I went back to what I actually set out to do originally. So I applied for a job at New Scientist, a two-day-a-week job. And the 2 days in question were Friday and Monday. So I don't think there's that much competition for that, really. And the guy who gave me the job was the man I'd written to all those years ago.
Schmidt stuck around long enough to turn that two-day-a-week job into a title, editor-in-chief.
That was kind of a triumph of sort, obviously, in the sense that it was the fulfillment of a very long-held ambition, I guess you could call it, even if not always a consciously held one. And it was a, you know, it was a new and stimulating creative challenge in the area that I'd always wanted to work in. You know, you have to talk to people who worked there for what they thought about it, but for me personally, it worked out great.
Based on what you know so far, it stands to reason that you would think Schmidt is, and always has been, an optimist. Because just look at how that all worked out for him.
You know, I had a good childhood, you know, I had a good family and a good environment. I did okay at school and all the rest of it. My career was, you know, as I kind of just talked about, reasonably smooth. So I had no real reason to expect that the world was going to be unkind to me.
Schmidt Paul Chowdhury is an astrophysicist turned journalist, and yes, the former editor-in-chief of New Scientist magazine. But Schmidt did not consider himself an optimist until a lifequake rocked his world. I'm going to read you the opening from the prologue of his book, The Bright Side, and it goes like this. The case for optimism. I became an optimist the night my wife died. People reacted in different ways to her diagnosis, an aggressive, fast-spreading ovarian cancer discovered after the miscarriage that ended our first and only pregnancy. Yeah. Turns out life was not going to just be kind to Schmidt.
I had always had a pretty good life up until that point. So when it kind of turned out that actually things were not going to go as easily as all that, that forced me to reevaluate. And I did a couple of things. So one of the things I did was I decided that, and this started out as a joke, really. It started out as kind of coping humor. So I'm going to be an optimist. And the reason that I say humor is because I thought of optimism as being kind of a fairly silly way to go, a frivolous way to approach things. You know, I thought, yeah, all right, fair enough. You can be an optimist and it's probably good to be, you know, cheerful rather than, you know, gloomy about the prospects. But I thought fundamentally, sort of, I thought that's not thinking very hard about the world. And I trained as a physicist. I worked as a journalist. You're supposed to, in both of those, whatever the realities may be, you're supposed to prize rationality and critical thinking and working on the basis of the evidence and all that kind of, you know, hard-headed stuff. So I thought I'm going to behave like an optimist. And a couple of things happened. One was that I acted like an optimist and I started to think, actually, you know, this is working. I was doing things that I thought would be helpful in engendering optimism, you know, engendering the sense that tomorrow would be better than today because today was obviously not great at that time. So I started to do these things, little exercises that I invented for myself, really, which turned out to be relatively close to the things that psychologists recommend. As it turned out, they were helpful. And I thought, actually, there's power here. There's something here. You know, this is not something I would necessarily have come to at another point in my life.
Through Schmidt's journey with grief, his critical thinking and scientific rigor couldn't simply accept that optimism works because it feels like it's working. If optimism really is a reliable resource that we can tap into when times are tough, Schmidt wanted to find out what a pragmatic, well-reasoned, evidence-based version of optimism could look like.
Ernest Shackleton is a great Anglo-Irish explorer. He set out to reach the North Pole in 1915. But his ship, the Endurance, became stuck in the ice in the Weddell Sea, which even today would be probably one of the most difficult places in the world to traverse. It is one of the most difficult places in the world to traverse. And eventually the ship sank. And he and his men were left out on the ice. They had to survive the Antarctic winter, first of all. And then after that, they have this problem when they're on the ice.
I need you to imagine it's 1915, and you have none of the technology we have today. They didn't have mobile devices or radio. They don't have GPS. They don't have tracking systems. They have nothing. They have no way of communicating with the outside world. There is, for all intent and purposes, no reason to expect anyone will come to save them. So if they're going to get out of this alive, they have to do it themselves. Ultimately, what counted in Ernest Shackleton's favor was the criteria that he had used to select the 27 men out of the more than 5,000 applicants to join him on this expedition. Here's Schmidt reading from The Bright Side.
Shackleton wasn't looking for tough guys. His criteria could appear quixotic, including everything from physical appearance to sense of humor. But, he said, the quality I look for most is optimism, especially optimism in the face of reverses and apparent defeat.
After their ship became stuck, the crew spent more than 5 months camped out on the ice before they set off to Elephant Island in lifeboats. Not that Elephant Island was much better, I'll have you know, except for the fact that it was solid ground and not ice floating in the ocean. Shackleton chose a few men from the crew, and they set off on another harrowing 2-week journey across the rough seas in South Georgia. These guys traveled more than 1,000 kilometers in lifeboats before they found a whaling station. And when they returned to rescue the men that had been left behind on Elephant Island, they failed 3 times trying to get back through the ice before the mission was successful.
At every stage of the troubled Imperial Transantarctic Expedition, Shackleton reminded his men that as long as they were alive, they had choices to make and options to explore, inspiring his weather-beaten, malnourished, and profoundly isolated crew to keep the faith. Not many of us will have our mettle tested as Shackleton and his team did, but we all have our reckonings with life or death sooner or later, and other adversities that make us reappraise the world and question the future. It's at such times optimism can be hardest to secure, but also the most valuable. Its value is also evident when it comes to more mundane challenges, a date, a job interview, a sports match. If we're downcast about some situation or other, the chances are that someone will tell us to look on the bright side, and the chances are that we will feel better if we do. And we may well find a solution to our problem once our mood lifts, if there is a solution to be had. Optimism, far from leading us to passively await our fates, can help us to actively explore our limitations and transcend them.
I asked Schmidt, what does optimism, in the face of reverses and apparent defeat, look like? You know, in case I need to select a few people to join me on a transatlantic cruise this year.
I think what it comprises is the willingness to believe that there are possibilities out there, even if you can't see them. And I think this is kind of something that we all encounter a point in our lives when we don't know what the way forward is going to be. So for me, I mean, when I was bereaved, I didn't know what the way forward was going to be. I mean, there was no clear path ahead. But you have a choice at times like that. And you have a choice when you're stranded on the ice of the Antarctic, I guess. You can either say there is no, you know, way forward, and that's that. Or you can say, I don't know what it is, but there is one. There will be one. I can find one. And either way, it's the logic of the self-fulfilling prophecy. If you incline to pessimism, and if you give in to pessimism, and you say there isn't a way forward, then you know you will do nothing about your situation, and your pessimism will be proven correct. If you are an optimist and you say, actually, I think there is a way out of this. Now, I'm not going to kind of claim that there's always a way out of any difficulty. There isn't always a way out of any difficulty, but if there is one, and it's one that's open to you, which more than often, you know, there is something you can do about your situation. You'll only find it if you believe it's there to be found and you try to seek it out. And that's particularly true when you don't know what the path ahead is. If you know what the path ahead is, then, you know, you don't necessarily need all of this kind of, emotional, irrational conviction. But it's when you don't know what the path ahead is, when you have to hope there is one, that's when it comes into its own.
I know this to be true. As Zoe's parents, Rue and I are eternally optimistic. We have to be. Because when the doctors say there is no way, our little girl still wants to try. They said she wouldn't walk, but then Zoe started crawling, and she has slowly progressed to bearing weight on her feet, to the point where she can now pull herself up into a standing position. So we got her a gait trainer. She didn't like it at first, but now she takes walks daily in this walker all through our neighborhood. Yep, there were a few of those in the joy jar too. Which brings us to the optimistic chickens.
So yeah, I mean, animals turn out to be almost, well, all the ones we looked at turn out to be optimistic in a specific sense. So the easiest way to explain this is to talk about how you test for optimism. And my favorite example is chickens. You teach chicks to associate, say, white cards with food. So you put up a white card and you put mealworms behind it. And you put up a black card and there's no mealworms behind that. And chickens gradually become used to the idea that knock over the white card and you'll find food, knock over the black card and you'll find nothing. And so what you do is, once they've learned this reliably, is you show them a grey card. And the grey card is between these two things. And this is kind of the chicken equivalent of the glass being half full or half empty. And most chickens, most of the time, go, it's more white than black, you know, I reckon. So they knock it down and they, you know, they find whatever you find, they find behind it. But this kind of propensity, this willingness to believe that there's going to be food, that this is going to be a positive thing, when, you know, logically they could equally well think this is more black than white, there's nothing there, and save themselves the energy, the effort of knocking it down. Really speaking, you talk about that as being a cognitive bias, a bias in the way that they think. Loosely speaking, you would call it optimism. And the reason scientists do these experiments is because they want to understand what makes animals sap happy, you know, what makes animals satisfied with their living conditions. As you might expect, chickens that lead more stressful lives are less optimistic than ones that have, you know, room to roam and, you know, enriching environments and so on. There are a variety of explanations for why this is true. The one that I like best is that it goes back to the self-fulfilling prophecy that we talked about earlier. If you don't know everything about the world, and if you're an animal, you don't know that much about the world besides the evidence of your senses and some experience, then you have to kind of have something that motivates you to go out and, you know, find food, to find a mate, to get on with your life. So there is an evolutionary logic to that. I find that argument quite compelling. And even if that's not how it happened in evolution, it still makes sense as a way to lead your life.
So if chickens benefit from a positive relationship between being optimistic, cards half white, and good life outcomes, what does that mean for humans?
Being an optimist is associated with living longer, being healthier for longer, and being happier. At least I say an association because it's kind of a circular process. If you're an optimist, you're more likely to do things that improve your life. If your life improves, then you're more likely to be an optimist. It's not a simple cause and effect. It goes round and round. What is also true is the opposite, which is that people who tend to score very low on optimism, people who are strongly pessimistic, that correlates highly with depression. And one of the hallmarks of depression is an inability to believe that taking action will improve your situation. It is that resignation to your situation. That's kind of one of the primary difficulties that people suffering with depression have, is being unable to believe that taking action will improve their lives. The evidence that you can change your level of optimism is not that strong. There are things you can do that modify it. I prefer to think of it in terms of you can target your optimism at the areas that you want to. But optimism is about targeting, you know, what you want to be optimistic about and trying to build evidence in your own mind that helps you to be optimistic about it. You can have too much optimism, it has to be said, but having kind of a reasonable amount of optimism encourages you to keep going when you know, as Shackleton put it, in the faces of reverses and apparent defeats, you know, you get knocked down, you get back up again. If you're an optimist, you're more likely to do that.
If you are going to be setting intentions for the new year, might I suggest training yourself to see the bright side? The glass half full, a year, 365 days ahead of you, full of moments of potential joy.
Do optimists have the power to change the world? I mean, I think they do. Almost go so far as to say only optimists change the world. Because I think that fundamentally, to change the world, you have to have an idea that a different world is possible. You have to kind of believe that with enough conviction to go after it and do things, you know, even if they're not necessarily rewarded, even if they're not necessarily viewed as being sensible things to do.
say, if chickens can do it, so can you. Go on, shift your outlook and change your world. Shifters, we'll see you again in 6 weeks. Subscribe to Something Shifted now and never miss a human-centered story. Many thanks to Rue, my executive producer, for additional writing on this episode. And as always, thank you for listening. Oh, and I nearly forgot to tell you that we're very excited to welcome our Season 4 sponsors, Solol, specialists in healthy aging, to the show. More about that next time. Bye.